Welcome back, everyone. It's great to see you all for the penultimate strong gravity seminar of this year. And it's a great pleasure to have Aaron Help with us today. He's a postdoc at the University of Jena and currently a visiting fellow at the Princeton Gravity Initiative. And he'll tell us about black holes beyond general relativity today. So welcome, Aaron, and please take it away.
Thanks a lot, Daniel, for the invitation and also for the kind introduction. So I want to start with saying that I think we can all agree that it's a very exciting time for black hole physics, mainly because the experimental collaborations of LIGO and the EHT are now able to provide us with data in not just one, but in, I would say, multiple new regimes. And so shadow observations probe the background spacetime, and gravitational waves then probe the actual dynamics, both the linear and the nonlinear dynamics. And really, it's now up to theorists to keep up with this amazing experimental progress and to make the most of this data. And in particular, I think this means that we have to go beyond just null tests of GR and actually make predictions for leading order corrections, whatever you mean by that, beyond GR. And to do so, today I want to briefly motivate what I mean by leading order corrections, and thereby I mean leading order effective field theory corrections to GR. And then my talk will consist of three successive parts going through these different regimes. First, on how to constrain new physics with black hole shadow observations, which will be at the level of background spacetimes, and then going to first linear and then nonlinear dynamics. All right, so let me start with a motivation. So I come from a high energy quantum gravity PhD education. So probably I have a different background than many of you. So for me also, the most exciting new physics candidate remains quantum gravity. So still, the motivation that I want to give somehow holds up for any type of local new physics that is associated with a fundamental scale in your beyond GR or beyond whatever theory, dark matter, dark energy. This new physics, or in my case, it's quantum gravity, may invoke some fundamental symmetries or mechanisms or whatever insights to predict some of the couplings as you try to map this to an effective theory at low energies. And it will predict these in terms of a bunch of free parameters. And so clearly we would like to test these predictions here. But that's not the only thing that matters, because if you want to, at least if you want to connect to a low energy local effective field theory, then also this effective field theory matters. And in particular, the scaling in these effective field theory matters. And in this low energy effective field theory, it will distinguish between classically suppressed couplings and classically unsuppressed, or people often call them marginal couplings. And this actually both matters for understanding which type of couplings will maybe have an impact on observational physics. So both regimes are crucial. And since EFT is generic, you would want to make predictions somewhere in this side. And this is actually fairly general. So coming from an EFT perspective, these would be the couplings. You can just go through writing down all the matter content and gravity. And these would be the couplings that you would want to focus on. Now, in the particle physics side, where I actually spent most of my PhD, the standard model couplings, at least most of them, are actually such marginal couplings. And this makes them an exciting probe of new physics, and even of new physics at so far removed scales as the Planck scale. So here, particle physicists like to think of scales in terms of energy, giga electron volts, but you can think of it as 1/length scales. And so this would be the Planck scale. And apart from interesting things happening up here, where actually new symmetries govern particular relations between these couplings, the point I want to make here is that order one couplings at this new scale are connected to order one couplings at lower scales and at observationally accessible scales. And This holds up also for a particular set of gravitational couplings. And these are the couplings which dress operators which are quadratic in curvature. And if you set up a whole basis of these couplings, and I will focus on pure gravity, then this is a complete basis. And this theory is then typically called quadratic gravity. There's actually quite a confusion in the literature of what to call quadratic gravity, but this makes sense to me. Quadratic in curvature is quadratic gravity. Now, if you want to probe this theory, it also means we have to go to the highest possible curvatures that we can encounter, because they come with an additional power in curvature as compared to just Einstein gravity. And black holes are a beautiful candidate of that. And that actually brings me to black hole phenomenology in these EFTs beyond GR. So here I show you again these leading order EFT corrections. And I want to make one more point about a principle that I should highlight, and that's the question of ghost modes. And here I want to talk about the classical theory. So I'm referring to two coupled but opposite sign kinetic terms in the modes of your theory. And these are generically present if you take a theory and you truncate it as an EFT. So if you cut off here, you will have these ghost modes, and indeed you have one ghost mode here. But we would consider them as truncation artifacts. So what we have to ensure is that the physics that we extract makes sense, even though there are these classical ghosts present in the theories. Now, this is opposite to what many other peoples do in constructing explicitly ghost-free theories. And that actually constrains a lot, meaning that if you want no extra degrees of freedom in your theory and you insist on ghost freeness, then in four dimensions, the field equations of GR, not the action, but the field equations are actually unique by Lovelock's theorem. And so what people here generally do is they introduce extra degrees of freedom. That brings you to theories like scalar tensor theories, vector tensor theories. The classical objections against these ghosts, and even if they are just truncation ghosts, we should pay attention to that. The classical objections are ghosts lead to ill-posed behavior, and ghosts lead to runaways, that is, physical instabilities. I just want to mention that both of these are not generally true. For the question of well-posedness, I'm going to get back to that in the last part of my talk. And for the question of instabilities, there's a very nice paper appeared this year in summer by Cedric, Shinji, and Alex, where they construct an explicit model of two oscillators, which is completely stable, and they can prove that. And I'm currently collaborating with them to extend that to field theory. In any case, so now we have three experimental opportunities to test these theories, whichever way you prefer, or actually whichever theory you prefer. You can test them at the level of the background spacetime, and you can test them with gravitational waves in the in spiral and in the ring down. This was typically linear dynamics. And then in between, in the short merger phase, we have a true probe of the nonlinear dynamics. And successively, you have to specify more about the theory that you're testing. Actually, I'm now working on all three parts here, and I will present work from all three parts at the level of the shadow observations. I want to remain fairly agnostic and just talk about background spacetimes and not specify any particular dynamics. This is actually something where I think the EHT is quite unique in that it only relies on the geodesic equation, but otherwise probes the background spacetime independent of dynamics. That's not true anymore for any of the gravitational wave signals, where it's a mixture of dynamics and background spacetime, or even full nonlinear spacetime, that matters for the observation. All right, so I want to start with image features in shadow observations. And I want to say again that I'm happy to take questions at any point. I'll also pause at the end of each part to hopefully get a lot of interesting questions. Here on the right.
Can I ask you? So, yeah, you mentioned this like this work that, you mentioned that ghost may not imply runaway, right? And yes. You say, yeah, the work is about a coupled oscillators. But in field theory, we have additional complication that we have infinite number of oscillators. And in some sense, runaway happens because of that, because the energy is transferred between, because phase space increases, you know, with frequency. So I think the example, if it's just mechanical example with a finite number of degrees of freedom, that may not be quite adequate for field theory. I actually don't know the work, so maybe you can say a bit more what was shown and how it can be extrapolated to field theory.
Yeah, so their work actually, they take an integrable model, which allows them to prove things because they can work out the constants of motion and they can explicitly talk about constraints on, they are able to show that the phase space evolution is confined in a finite region in phase space, which means there cannot be any runaways. And the proof strategy relies on integrability.
But I agree with Sergei. That was a very, very, very special example. I mean, this is not what you would have generically in PDEs.
I agree that it's a special example. And it's much, much harder to prove things in higher dimensions, so in field theories. But we have now simulations, and hopefully they'll be out in a few weeks or so, where we can go to 1+1 and also 2+1 dimensional field theories. And these models still are stable. They don't show physical runaways. And since it's just numerical work, we can only do so in random initial data, confined and stuff.
Sure, but
we can't prove things.
But we also have mathematical theorems that will tell you it will happen. So, I mean, the fact that one can construct specific examples where the phenomenology will not be present does not preclude that the generic problem you're going to see when you have this kind of structure is this problem. So I actually think I was not very happy to see that paper because it just adds noise and forgets all the mathematical knowledge. And I don't think it's a good contribution.
No, but here they have a sound proof. So it's not like it's an example for how these general theorems do not apply. And I think the physical explanation is that the interaction potential, which is present at local interactions, as the phase space is probed at large phase space variables, in particular, just X and Y of these oscillators becoming large, the interaction part of the potential shuts off dynamically. And that counteracts the runaway. And if the power with which it shuts off is high enough, it removes the runaway. And you have actually stable evolution everywhere in phase space.
Yeah, so I don't want to discuss their work. We're here to hear yours, but I would stay with my point that it's a very, very particular example.
I agree that it's a contrived example, but what is nice about it, I think, is that one can go and test now if you truncate this contrived example, how this affects the effective field theory and whether you can explore this complete theory, which is actually then stable, order by order in effective field theory. I'm happy to discuss this much more, but I think it's a meaningful point to state that there are exceptions to these general theorems.
Yeah, and may I ask another thing? So you say you tend to interpret these ghosts as artifact of truncation. Yes, so basically quadratic truncation.
Yes,
and I imagine you think they will be removed if you include all series that we expect to generate in the expansion. But then I wonder to what extent then the conclusions which are based just on this truncation are robust against inclusion of higher order terms.
This I very much agree with. One has to be very careful in how far one can extract predictions from these terms while working in a truncation that you assume to resum to something that does not have these sigmodes present. Yes, I agree that that's a something that one has to be careful of.
Okay, are you going to say more about this later in your talk?
So I will first be concerned with trying to make work the classical theories in the second two part, in the second and third part of my talk. I think if we have the theories, actually the full nonlinear theory under mathematical control, this is what will actually allow us to ask these questions meaningfully, because before we have them under mathematical control, it's hard to tell apart mathematical properties like an ill-posed set of equations from properties that come from the presence of this ghost.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, are there more questions on this introduction? Okay, great. Otherwise, now let me revert completely, forget about any particular dynamics. Here I'm showing simulated images of rotating black holes, and I obtain these by numerical ray tracing in the presence of a non-dynamical, so no GRMHD yet, disk model. And on the left, you see just Kerr at significantly high spin. And on the right-hand side, you see a modified space-time with the same asymptotics based on a particular set of new physics principles applied at the level of the space-time, which I'll explain in much detail. What you can immediately appreciate is that the differences will be quite hard to detect. And that brings me to the two approaches that are typically followed in the literature. One approach is to take your favorite theory beyond GR, calculate a particular solution, on that solution, calculate the shadow image to some degree of, actually not many shadows are calculated at the level of actually doing ray tracing with a disk present. The other approach is to use parameterized deviations, and you would want to parameterize all possible deviations from an axially symmetric solution in GR. And since these effects will be hard to detect anyways, I think we should focus on generic effects first. And at the same time, we want to tie these generic effects to fundamental physics, because we want to learn something from the observation about fundamental physics. We want to constrain this fundamental physics. And so I think it calls for something in between these approaches, where we try to identify characteristic image features in not just one space-time, but a family of space-times, which is based on fundamental physics principles. And then you can actually obtain image features. And here you see a preview of these. I'll come to this in much more detail. Excitingly, this formalism also teaches us a new lesson about these parameterized deviations, which was a surprise to me, but I'll come to that in the end of this part. So we construct families of space-time starting from Kerr, here in metric form, and in horizon-penetrating ingoing Kerr coordinates. So phi and u are passive coordinates associated with the Killing symmetries, while r and theta actually appear as active coordinates in the metric. M denotes the mass, and a is the dimensionless spin parameter. So let me mention that while this metric looks very complicated, Kerr spacetime in a very specific way is actually not very complicated. So if you look at it at the level of Riemann invariants, so you write down a basis of all possible Riemann invariants, it's a finite basis, and you find only one complex invariant which is independent, and it's as simple as that. Now, why am I telling you that? I'm telling you that because this reveals many of the mysterious properties of Kerr, or mysterious. It tells you that there's a hidden constant of motion, it's related to the Petrov type, being Petrov type D, and it explains the Neumann-Janus miracle that you can obtain Kerr from Schwarzschild spacetime by a complex coordinate transformation. Now, I'm making this point because this can also teach us, this approach can also teach us lessons about entire classes of spacetimes and not just about Kerr. And some of these on a mathematical level connect actually all the way to image features. All right, going back to the metric, which you're probably more familiar with, the modifications that we introduce are only affecting the mass. So we only make this mass space-time dependent. And that's, of course, not the only modification that you can make. There's many other inequivalent deformations that you can perform. Choosing this particular one comes from insight from actually many different quantum gravity theories that tell you that an effective weakening of the gravitational force, so the Newton constant, or equivalently an effectively smaller mass, is something that can lift the central singularity.
Aaron, can I ask a question? I mean, you said that they come from many different quantum gravity theories.
Yes.
So as far as I know, there isn't one. So you're saying semi-classical arguments, or what particular quantum gravity are you thinking about? Are you saying there is a complete quantum theory of gravity out there where I can ask this question?
No, obviously there's not a complete theory. It would be amazing if there's a complete, it depends on what you mean by complete, but I don't think there's a complete quantum gravity approach out there. That's actually why I think that it's important in quantum gravity that approaches start identifying common ground and common features, such as this one, that for instance, in loop quantum gravity, you also typically get, because effectively your space-time is discrete, and as you start, or maybe it has a discrete spectrum, and as you probe this regime, you start effectively weakening the gravitational force. That's why you get these cosmological bouncing scenarios. And the same applies to where I come from asymptotically safe quantum gravity, where we can specify a particular scaling that you expect from a UV fixed point being present in this theory. Again, the gravitational force is weakened. And I think it's a fairly general thing that you would want quantum gravity models to do.
So you're saying that from different, the leading order effect that you can draw from whatever options are out there, putative hopes for quantum gravity, they all kind of, there's this common effect that gravity waves is weakened. And so that's what you're going to introduce here.
Well, right, thank you. Really, I'm just using it as a motivation to look at modifications of this particular type. And for instance, not of modifications of the spin parameter.
All right, thank you.
Okay, perfect. And then you can apply, or we apply a set of principles. So at the level of the space-time, not at the level of the action or the dynamics. And in particular, we want all the curvature invariants, whereby I mean all the Riemann invariants, to be regular everywhere in the space-time. That's what we call regularity. We obviously still want an asymptotically Newtonian limit. We want new physics to be simple. I'll explain that in more detail. But essentially, it boils down to wanting a single new physics scale and not multiple scales, because then you can essentially do anything.
I kept thinking about that. So one usual thing that one hears about the quantum theory of gravity, one thing it will not allow us to have is a naked singularity. So it will not allow us to have spins too large or charges that are too large. But here you're kind of going in the opposite way. You're going to say, I'm going to weaken the mass. But wouldn't that, if I'm in a very, very high spinning regime, and the main effect would be to lower the mass, would you not then run closer to unraveling a singularity?
That's a very good question. You would run closer to overspinning the geometry, in a sense of the horizon disappearing. But if your theory actually removes the central singularity, actually by now I think it should remove the Cauchy horizon. So there might be different principles that you would want to apply. But if it makes the interior of the black hole a well-defined thing, it doesn't matter anymore if the horizon disappears in principle.
Okay, thank you. That's fine.
All right. And taking these first three principles is actually sufficient to generally conclude that the horizon shrinks. And in spherical symmetry, again, you can prove that formally. In axial symmetry, it's a little harder to prove, but in this class of metrics that we have, it's certainly true. So, and the way you can understand this physically is that the effective mass has to vanish at the center with a particular power to remove all the to remove the singularity from all curvature invariants. And at asymptotic infinity, it has to asymptote to a constant value to give you the ADM mass of that metric. And in between, simplicity, which you can just think of Taylor expanding around both regimes and wanting these Taylor expansions to match in between. This simplicity tells you that the increase in mass has to be monotonous. And if it's monotonous, it means that the mass is effectively smaller at all scales in between. So the horizon will also shrink. Actually, the whole geometry becomes successively more compact. And the locality principle, which will be very important with regards to image features, by that I mean that we want the new physics, any modifications that we introduce, we want them at the level of the space-time to be tied to local curvature scales of curved space-time. And for that, I first must specify what are local curvature scales of curved space-time. And that brings me back to this complex invariant that I've showed you in the beginning, because since it's complex, it means that if you work out real invariants, you have two independent pieces. So you have actually incur two independent invariants that if you go to the same space-time point, the invariants have different values. And so you need to first specify what you mean by curvature being large, curvature being small. And coming from an EFT perspective, it makes a lot of sense to say whenever any of these curvature invariants becomes large, we would expect corrections. So following this, we construct a combined invariant, which by now we actually understand is nothing but the absolute value of this complex invariant that I showed you before. We construct this combined invariant, which is an envelope of the maximum of all curvature invariants. And here you can see this invariant. The blue line is the blue wiggly line is the actual absolute value of the maximum of all curvature invariants. And the contours, the green ones that you see here, they are this invariant that we construct, and they actually approximate this exact absolute value very, very well. All right, and with that invariant, we now tie any new physics to that invariant. And that, obviously, since the invariant depends on the polar angle, the new physics will also depend on the polar angle. And so the horizon here, I'm just showing a sketch of it in these horizon penetrating coordinates, will pick up an angular dependence. And that is what leads to an additional class of image features. All right, so here's the summary of these image features, three plots, again, focusing on the prograde side of the shadow.
Could you go back? I'm trying to understand this figure. What is the wiggly line?
The wiggly line is you take all the curvature invariants, all the real independent curvature invariants, and you calculate all of them at a particular space-time point. You form the maximum and you take the absolute value. That's the wiggly line, because that's what you would, from an EFT perspective, think of as where new physics comes in.
So, but why is it wiggly? I mean, what makes it do this thing?
Because the invariants can cross through each other, and they can cross even zero. So they can become positive and negative. That makes it have discontinuous points.
So what sets the wavelength of these oscillations?
That's a good question. First of all, I wouldn't call it a wavelength, but...
Well, whatever you want to call them, the wiggliness.
I would think it's the spin parameter that sets that, but I would have to check.
Okay, good. Thanks.
All right. So again, these are three images. On the left, you see Kerr. Again, it's only the part of the image that is on the prograde side where stuff happens. Here you see Kerr. Here you see the three principles applied, but not demanding local new physics in a sense of curvature scales. And here you see all four principles applied. You can immediately appreciate differences, and I'll get to that. But before so, I want to emphasize that I have maximized effects in a couple of ways. I look now completely edge-on inclination that maximizes the effect. I look at large spin parameter, which maximizes the effect. I look at a particular mass function with a slow fall off, so that effects become as large as possible in some sense. And I tie the new physics scale to the mass scale of the black hole. That's something that, I mean, if you expect physics, Planck scale, quantum gravity physics, you would tie that not to the mass scale of the black hole, but to the Planck scale, which would suppress all of these features vastly. So if you wanted to be tied not to the black hole scale, but to the Planck mass, then you have to come up with qualitatively different features, such as we discussed in the beginning, the presence or absence of an horizon to find image features. But here I'm just interested in generic image features of these classes of metrics. And what you can also immediately see is that what will matter is the n equals one, which is this, and the n equals two photon ring. And so if you have the n equals two photon ring, you would actually start to be able to probe the sort of the shape of this thing and start to probe deviations. Now, but since the n equals two is probably something that we will only have access to in space-based future EHT observations, if you focus on the n equals one, you definitely need to focus on some temporal variability. So as long as we cannot do that, we need to somehow rely on this temporal variability to remove degeneracy with unknown disk physics. And as part of the next generation EHT fundamental physics working group, I think we're starting to collaborate and quantify what this entails in constraining these geometries already with Earth-based measurements. All right, now on the particular features, you see that the shadow—
May I ask you, so—
Sure.
Yes, yeah, I'm a bit confused. So you predict, this model predicts temporal variability or? Yeah, you say we should focus on temporal variability. So why is that?
No, that's really just for temporal variability, not in a sense of the space-time metric, but in a sense of accretion or flares in the accretion flow, because that will give you brightness regions at different, for instance, radii in the space-time. So that will probe the space-time at different levels. And that's something that can get rid of underlying additional effects that you get from having to model the accretion disk. So the difficulty here is not about an exact prediction that you would get in a particular disk model. The difficulty is telling apart physics in the accretion dynamics, so astrophysics, from fundamental physics. And temporal variability is one way of potentially doing that.
I see. Thanks.
All right, so the two features which are generic to just the first three principles applies is that the shadow shrinks. I told you that the horizon shrinks, and you can see here that all the photon rings move to the right, or probably in your image to the right. And that's just a feature that just shows you that the shadow shrinks. The photon rings are also successively stretched out, so the Lyapunov exponent is changed in the geometry. And that's actually something that might be interesting also, because it means that if you look at Kerr and the critical resolution where you would resolve the n equals two, that critical resolution is lowered. So some of these things may actually be excluded before we can measure the n equals two photon ring in Kerr spacetime. And then there are two further image features which only pop up if you apply the locality principle. I don't want to talk much about asymmetry. It requires you to tilt out of the equatorial plane to see that, but I want to focus on these cuspy features. You can see them here already. And they form in all of the light rings, becoming successively sharp, and in the shadow boundary, they're also present. In any case, these you can tie to the locality principle. And that's because the locality principle was what introduced an angular dependence in the horizon. So here you see the horizon radius and the polar angle, and you see Kerr, and you see the modified geometry, which picks up an angular dependence. And this non-spherical horizon leads to different, qualitatively different classes of photon orbits that you can have in the geometry. And here you see two of them. One of them causes oscillations in theta, which are symmetric about the equatorial plane. And the other type of orbit causes oscillations which just happen in one half of the space-time. And quite clearly, these will have different critical curves. And the actual critical curve is a composition of these. And so whenever you transition from one behavior to the other, you get one of these cusps in the image. And so that's...
Can I ask you, Aaron, how did you apply locality principle to metric? I don't quite follow how locality tells you.
Yeah, this is what I was saying by we demand that the deviations from Kerr are tied to local curvature scales of Kerr. That's how we apply locality at the level of the metric. I agree with you that this is not necessarily the same as applying locality at the level of an action. But I want specifically this analysis to be independent of dynamics.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Because so that's a feature of the EHT.
With such a large variation of the photon orbits, has anyone thought even was kind of field propagating on this background, presumably would have made a clear impact on the waveforms of say GW150914 if the metric
but that's correct, but that's again a question of dynamics.
Yeah.
So it definitely, and I will come to that, it definitely okay. requires you to specify the dynamics.
Sure.
All right.
Do you mind if I ask a question here too? So I'm a little bit confused. So at the beginning you said that, you know, with these theories you're considering, you know, they introduce new physics sort of below some length scale, and then we want to look for the sort of highest curvature systems to probe them, right? But yes. Then you're talking about the HT, which probes supermassive black holes. So if you had any sort of observable effect for supermassive black holes, wouldn't you expect the effect to be, you know, a million to some power times larger for stellar mass black holes?
Yes, you're perfectly right. If you assume the exact same local physics for stellar mass black holes and supermassive black holes, I would expect these effects to have modified the stellar mass black holes in a much larger way. Yes.
So, and that's kind of true for this, the whole class of theories you mentioned.
I think that's true for any local physics. It's just the statement that stellar mass black holes probe much, much larger curvature scales than supermassive black holes. Yes. So in some sense, I agree that's against having a purely local new physics theory.
Okay, thanks.
All right. So what's very interesting is that we can tie these image features back to a mathematical property of these spacetimes. And that mathematical property is circularity. And that teaches us actually something about parameterized approaches. So here you see the mathematical definition of circularity. It's just a contraction property of the Ricci tensor with the killing vectors, which are Xi1 and Xi2, of the spacetime. And physically, you can think of it as inverting the time coordinate and the spin direction, so the two coordinates that correspond to the killing vectors, and the spacetime being invariant under that combined inversion. And that's true for Kerr spacetime. It's actually important for deriving a lot of interesting theorems, uniqueness theorems in GR. It's not true for any of the spacetimes tied to local curvature scales of Kerr. That's just an observation at this point. What's interesting is that general parameterizations that have been used to analyze in particular EHT data, they all are circular. The complete parameterizations are circular, which means that these parameterizations miss any of these image features that I was talking about that is tied to local curvature scales. And that's a more general statement of caution that I want to make. And you can understand that just at the level of writing down the most general metric in axisymmetry and stationarity. That that doesn't tell you whether any of the metric elements has to be zero. It just tells you that it should depend only on two, namely the active coordinates of the metric. Now, to remove metric elements, you have to perform coordinate transformations. And modulo subtlety is about disconnected classes of spacetimes. One can perform four coordinate transformations to remove four metric elements at most. So that brings you down to still at least six metric, three metric elements. And that's different from the five free metric elements that the parameterizations use, and that can be explained in terms of circularity. It actually makes sense also in this inversion type of argument, because T phi and all of the diagonal elements are obviously the only ones which are invariant under exchange of the T and phi coordinates. In any case, circularity is a specification which I see no real physical motivation for. It also, for instance, excludes particular solutions to scalar tensor theories. And you can apply additional things, like you want the spacetime to have hidden symmetries. And there's actually a very nice work by Benenti and Franca Viglia, which constructs the whole possible class of spacetimes which have such a separability to structure. And in any case, that restricts the spacetime further. And I would say we should at least also probe metrics at this level. And that's just where I want to end out and say that. Stay tuned for more on that. And that actually brings me to the end of the first part. So if you have more questions, please go ahead. All right. And then let me just ask, in terms of organization, since there's lots of questions coming already, should I try to still stick to the 45 minutes? Because then I would skip the second part.
I believe it's up to you. If you want to skip, that's fine. We are a little flexible on time. So if you can do it in a few minutes, that's fine too.
Okay.
I don't know for how long you planned the second part.
Well, I planned the second part for like 10-ish minutes, but I want to get to the third one. So,
okay, then maybe let's focus on the third one then.
Okay, then I'll skip linear stability and just say that we're able to make statements about this particular null dynamics, specifying again to theories of quadratic, or the theory of quadratic gravity. We're now able to make statements not just about the Schwarzschild solution in spherical symmetry, but also about the exotic branch in spherical symmetry by just calculating quasi-normal mode spectra, or put differently, bound state spectra, and inferring something about the stability properties. We're now able to address this second branch and show that there's also a Gregory Laflamme type instability here, which means that these black holes will presumably, at least following from a linear stability analysis, be confined to regimes above a certain threshold horizon value. All right, and now let me get to the third part concerning nonlinear evolution, because I think that's actually interesting. And I'm particularly happy to be able to talk about this today, because Hyun Lim and I, we met at PI when we were both visiting a while ago. And so it's kind of nice to take this back. So we actually started collaborating at PI. So again, I'm focusing on the theory of quadratic gravity. And to talk about nonlinear evolution, we have to somehow talk about well-posedness of the initial value problem in quadratic gravity. So as in GR, the nonlinear evolution comprises PDEs, and in turn that relies on formulating a well-posed initial value problem. And of course, many of you know that this is nothing but saying that an initial value problem is well posed if it exists for all future time, if it's unique, and it continuously depends on initial data. And in GR, this was famously first proven, or the existence was proven by Ivan Choquet-Bouha. And then it took very long to actually establish that and perform actual simulations. That's partly because of evolution in computer power, but also because it's much harder to actually obtain the evolution than to prove existence. And I want to highlight here this work by Zabach, because they actually prove strong hyperbolicity for the BSSN formulation of GR. And that might be interesting for generalizing this to quadratic gravity in the future. I'll come to that in the very end. So also for quadratic gravity, much less famous, but indeed there exists the same proof of existence and uniqueness by David Noakes in the 80s. I'll get to the proof structure. And we are now trying to find an explicit formulation, first in spherical symmetry, where we've actually achieved that, and we are currently going towards 3+1. So to summarize the proof, because I think it makes insightful points, you decompose the theory into something that resembles the linear degrees of freedom by introducing fiducial variables. Here, this is a fiducial Ricci scalar and a fiducial traceless Ricci tensor. Hence, I'm using these curly R's. And you will have to apply additional constraints to ensure that these fiducial variables correspond to the actual curvature of this metric. And this just gives you a bunch of extra constraints on the theory. And then these are second order quasi-linear equations plus constraints. They correspond to the linear degrees of freedom. And in a second step, you can diagonalize the system. That's actually what Noakes does. He applies a generic diagonalization procedure. The details are not all too important. What you get is, again, second order quasi-linear larger system, but it's now diagonal. And this fact of being diagonal is not true for all theories. They have to fulfill certain criteria. But if you can make them diagonal, Liray's theorem guarantees you, if that also applies for the constraints, well-posedness of an initial value problem for sufficiently smooth initial data. And that's basically the proof strategy. And we actually repeat that and take that to, for instance, the spherically symmetric case, where you have to make one additional, there's one more subtlety, namely coordinates, because you would like to use coordinates which are adapted to the spherical symmetry, but explicit spherically symmetric coordinates prohibit harmonic gauge. And harmonic gauge is crucial for the proof strategy of Noakes. And we circumvent that problem by something that's known from GR called the cartoon method. Essentially, it just keeps Cartesian coordinates, but still makes use of all of the killing symmetries to simplify the evolution equations. And here you see the remaining three variables that we then want to evolve. Then we reduce, we do the same thing as Noakes, we diagonalize to a second order form. We actually go to a first order form in time, and this is the final system that we put on the computer. And in terms of results, I want to just highlight the bottom line, namely numerical stability. We find that the evolution that we look at is numerically stable. And numerically is important here. That does not tell us anything yet about physical stability, about runaways. So this is a completely different question. While this is no proof of well-posedness, it's very good evidence that the formulation is well-posed. And here you see this evidence in flat spacetime where we just plot the Hamiltonian constraint, where we obviously there's numerical noise, but we control the level of that noise at initial, and you see the noise decays, and there's no sign of any ill-posedness in the system. And that applies to flat spacetime, and it also applies to Schwarzschild spacetime. All right.
Can I interrupt, sorry, with the question? Sure. So with this quadratic gravity, am I correct in saying that any solution of the Einstein equations that's Ricci flat is also a solution of this theory?
Yes, and we do make use of this here because otherwise it would be hard to construct initial data.
Okay, so Schwarzschild is also just a solution of this theory as well. Okay. Did you try any non-Ricci flat backgrounds? Because I guess well-posedness is a statement about some particular background.
Yeah, not yet. And in particular, I think we will have to find these other black hole solutions. We will have to find them in evolution because it's not trivial to construct Actually, in spherical symmetry, it might be possible to construct initial data, but in general 3+1, it will be very hard to produce non-GR initial data, I think. But so we haven't fully explored, even in spherical symmetry, sort of all the possible black hole branches and stuff. This is something that I think is exciting now, to look at, for instance, critical collapse and what type of black holes form. But we haven't done that yet.
Okay, thanks.
And the main reason why we haven't done that, if you give me 5 more minutes, is that we are currently more excited about trying to go to 3+1. Here you now see what I had sketched only beforehand, the actual evolution equations of the theory. So we introduce, again, first order variables, as Noakes did too. And then we want to perform a 3+1, or we perform an extended 3+1 decomposition. And that, to guide your eye, gives us evolution equations and the sufficient number of constraints for these evolution equations. And here you see the evolution variables. The metric sector really remains as in ADM decomposition. And then there's a scalar degree of freedom, which has one and a first order variable, two evolution equations for one degree of freedom. And then you have a larger traceless tensor, which is decomposed into these curly A's and curly B's, which mirrors the massive spin 2 degree of freedom. And here there are additional constraints which you need to sort out to understand that this is actually the 5 degrees of freedom that you would associate with the massive spin 2.
Aaron, have you guys looked at the characteristics? I mean, are they all propagating the speed of light? There is a coupling here. So are the characteristics affected or not?
We don't fully know yet. So we are only about to put this, or we are currently putting this system on a computer, and at the same time trying to explore by reducing to this. I will comment on that in a bit. So here you now see the actual evolution equations, and I'm hiding all terms which are independent, so which don't contain any derivatives. They are hidden in these curly O notations here. So you only see derivative terms. And in particular, you see these terms here, which are known to be dangerous because they have mixed second order spatial derivatives. And at that point, I'm actually happy for any type of comments. So here, this is what is dangerous in BSSN. And BSSN, you actually introduce a conformal connection function. And importantly, you use the momentum constraint to remove spatial derivatives from this evolution. And this is what makes BSSN well posed. That also means that we need to evolve this constraint. We can't just apply it, because if we apply it, we kind of reverse what BSSN has done. It also means that here, presumably, things will work out the same way as in BSSN, because it's the same Ricci tensor that appears. But here, things might be more difficult. So the reason why we're still optimistic that this, nevertheless, if you apply BSSN, it might be a well-posed system, is that these massive spin 0 and massive spin 2 sectors, they do not impact the massless spin 2 sector. In particular, they do not impact the principal part of that sector. And as I said, the constraint, if we evolve the constraint, this preserves BSSN. And the system is, so far I've gone, is amenable to now also reduce the spatial derivatives to first order, which makes it an even larger set. It will be hard algebraically, but I think one can, in principle, repeat a strong hyperbolicity analysis as Zabach did. And this, I think, as Lewis said, will tell us about the characteristics. And essentially, one can prove or disprove strong hyperbolicity of this particular formulation. And we are currently doing both things simultaneously, trying to advance in this proof and learn about potentially having to apply further constraints to find the well-posed formulation. And at the same time, test in numerical simulations whether there are terms which are dangerous or not. And by that, kind of hybrid method learning about a well-posed formulation. And with that, I can actually conclude and remain with my statement that I think it's a highly exciting time to probe black hole physics in different regimes, in actually not just GR, but in the EFT of gravity. And I hope that there's more questions. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Aaron, for a very, very interesting talk. We had lots of questions already, but I'm sure there might be more. Any questions or comments? Yeah, I see Luis.
Yeah, can you go one slide back? Maybe this might help you. I'm not sure. But one way I understand, I mean, of course, there are many ways of understanding why BSSN ends up being well posed, and why do you have to bring the momentum constraint? And I mean, there's a lot of words associated to that that different people choose to give. I'll give you mine. So you are familiar, I'm sure, with the way the harmonic formulation achieves a symmetric hyperbolic system, because it gets rid of the piece, as you pointed out, in the RAB. That has derivatives that in principle you cannot control.
Yes.
But the same thing you can pull out in the three-dimensional slice. And so if you can use again the donder to rewrite RAJ, you would have a piece that knows about the coordinates and a piece that is kind of the second derivative of the metric. And there is where you say, oh, I need to introduce a gauge to control that piece. And that's what BSN is doing. So it's
yes.
Trying to get rid of that little piece. So maybe you can follow the same recipe here. It doesn't have to follow the BSN line by line, but that general principle is fine. What I'm concerned more is that even if you end up with a strong hyperbolic system, because of these couplings, and if the characteristics are to change, then you might have now a crossing of characteristics, which still is fine. It doesn't have to be a problem, but it means one needs to now endow the system with further conditions to pick a unique solution, because once the characteristics cross, then you have to impose something to pick the solution that you would call physical.
Yes, but this in some sense gets also closer to a physical statement about there being or not being further well-posed evolution, right?
I'm not sure I understood what I mean. When they cross, so you can, it will get in the way of, because you lose uniqueness. So then it's well posed will go out of the window unless the extra condition allows you to pick a unique one. So that's what you do in hydrodynamics, right? So the Rankine Hughey knot conditions are precisely going after that.
Yeah, what I was getting at is that whether a dynamical loss of well-posedness is going to tell you that there just is no well-posed evolution beyond that point, or whether you will have to change your formulation to keep a well-posed formulation. Because these are, I think, two different things, and one is teaching you something about physics and the other is not necessarily.
Sure. I actually think that once one opens the door to beyond GR, my guess is that generically one will end up with a situation where well-posedness can be ascertained with respect to a subset of initial conditions. So I don't think any of or most other theories beyond GR will be generically well-posed regardless of the initial data. It will, mm-hmm. In fact, even the very EFT that you would kind of argue allows you to write the correcting terms already would fail. We know the word will fail because the leading term GR, we know leads to singularities. So if you are gonna, or dispersion, so you're gonna be having to be in a regime where dispersion is one way or another underlying the dynamics. Otherwise, you're gonna run into a regime that at very least the EFT argument will cease to be valid. So I think at the end of the day, we're going to be saying this theory is sound when studying these kind of problems.
Mm-hmm. I think that's well possible to be one way that these things, and I think that something similar has been seen in EDGB, right? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that we keep seeing again and time and again.
Yes.
The same. Yeah.
But so to me, it's important to understand whether I will, and in some sense, we already know, I agree that that's not true for GR, but am I able to always hide things in high curvature regions where I would then include the next order in an EFT? Or do I have breakdowns of well-posedness even in arbitrarily low curvature regions, similar to a Cauchy horizon problem in Kerr space time? Because if I have that, it means that the how I build theories beyond GR cannot become from a purely local EFT reasoning, because I would not expect any local EFT corrections at that scale. I think that's one of the very important questions to answer, and I think to answer with these type of studies.
I agree. Yeah, thank you.
More questions?
If there are no other questions, I was going to ask Aaron, can you give the short spiel of the portion you didn't get to cover? Because in particular, I want too many questions.
Yeah, sure, I can do that. Is there a particular thing that you were interested in, or should I just give you I gave a very short version, which presumably you.
Yeah, you said you could argue that you could say kind of from more general arguments, what regime would you have black hole solutions that are stable? And
yes, I mean, for context, maybe it's interesting that in this study by Kelly Stella and collaborators, they apply, so they are able to do the analysis about the Schwarzschild branch, which is obviously just horizon equals 2m. This is just this branch. The other branch has a different relation between the horizon radius and the asymptotic mass. That's how it's presented in these type of plots. They agree at this crossing point. And what was known previously is that this bit of Schwarzschild is unstable and this bit of Schwarzschild is stable. And there's actually lots of analysis about this point, mainly because this is one of the examples where a linear theory can be the same linear degrees of freedom on that background for vastly different physical systems. So in particular, you get exactly the same perturbation equation from taking five-dimensional solutions and compactifying one of the dimensions, then you get to what is known a Gregory-Laflamme instability. And that's part of the reason why this instability has actually been now rigorously mathematically proven, not in the full regime, not all the way down to zero here, but in a subset, it's rigorously proven. Here you can see it just as the first bound state, the fundamental bound state frequency having a positive imaginary part. And that is what changes here between a stable regime and an unstable regime on Schwarzschild spacetime. Carrying that to another background solution is difficult in many ways. It's difficult because you will have to redo the way that the decomposition of modes works and everything is tailored to the GR background. So we had to redo that for a general background. We could do that. So this, we are able to arrive again at a single spherically symmetric perturbation equation for the monopole mode. And now the potential here depends on the beyond GR background and on the dynamics. So for instance, the masses of these additional degrees of freedom. And by that, we can just again do a bound state analysis. And we actually do find again, and this is surprising because here people have argued in terms of thermodynamics that this might be the stable branch. Now we are really fairly sure, or we are sure, because we perform the background, you have to approximate it numerically. So this is difficult because you're doing a quasi-normal mode or a bound state analysis, so numerics on top of a numerically approximated or algebraically just by an expansion approximated background. So you will have effects of these two approximations mixing, and therefore like really solidly proving convergence is difficult. But we perform two different types of things, one completely numeric and one with an analytic expansion of the background. And here you see the error that we get between these two expansions. But what's important is that clearly at the branch point, this seems incredibly converged. And we do find a positive imaginary part on the lower side of this critical value. And that suggests that this is the stable branch and not this is the stable branch, which tells you that in this theory and at this point, actually, I think it's questionable whether this is still valid in an EFT sense. So for here, it's just a full classical theory, which we take completely seriously. And here, black holes would evolve with lowering the asymptotic mass. They would evolve to have a lowest possible horizon radius from which on the horizon would then grow again. I think this happens by, I actually don't know how this dynamically happens, which is a motivation to explore this in the nonlinear regime.
So can you not just evolve these with the code you mentioned in the third part?
Sorry, with what?
Can you not just evolve these spherically symmetric black holes that you think are unstable with the nonlinear code that you mentioned in the third part?
Yes, exactly. That's precisely what we want to use this for. It just requires us to set up all the proper tracking the horizon excision techniques and actually, because you need to properly understand what black hole you're looking at in the end. So we just haven't performed the suitable numerical simulations yet.
Okay, but that doesn't require you to go to 3D or anything, right? You could just do that in spherical symmetry.
Yes, very much so, yeah.
Okay.
All right. I'll actually unshare to see you for a bit.
Hey, any final questions for Aaron?
I have another one. So related to the question that Will asked, so can you put again the action of your quadratic gravity that you're... So it's just almost Lovelock, except that you have some parameters?
It's not. I mean, Lovelock is an entire function, right?
Right. So now I'm using the wrong terminology. So
I have trouble of sharing and stuff. Now I have to find Zoom again.
That's okay. It's your action is like the Ricci plus then alpha RAB RAB. Plus some beta R square.
Yes, the R squared is not that dangerous. It's really just a scalar degree of freedom. What's crucial is the Ricci tensor, or equivalently the Weyl tensor.
Oh, you have the Weyl tensor in.
You can use the Gauss-Bonnet identity to recast the Ricci tensor traced into stuff that you can. You can reformulate it as Ricci squared plus Weyl tensor squared.
Well, the question is that some time ago we were talking about these things, but if I have alpha, say R squared plus beta RAB, RAB, right? Why can I not just, if alpha and beta are constant, why can I just not use the Gauss-Bonnet identity and then basically said in vacuum, I'm not adding anything?
Sorry, say that again. So why to get to what? So why can't you do that to get to what?
So I pull up a factor one of alpha, and or I use the Gauss-Bonnet to end up writing the whole thing as Gauss-Bonnet plus something that is zero on in the vacuum case.
Well, yeah, because you're willing. You can trade the Ricci squared bit for a Weyl tensor squared bit by the Gauss-Bonnet identity, but you can't remove both.
But on shell, it would be, on shell, I would have nothing.
If you applied on shell equations of motion, then yes. But that corresponds to like, it's not obvious to me what that does to a matter sector, for instance.
And no, that I understand. With the matter sector, but then in your case, where you are in vacuum, why do you get other solutions? That's what I'm getting confused with. Because on shell, you haven't added anything.
Well, because by removing that, you're using the on-shell equations of motion of GR, right? And you could maybe you can argue for that in an EFT.
Uh-huh.
But if you don't use the on-shell equations of GR,
right,
then you get additional solutions.
Okay, I need to think about it. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Any final questions or thoughts? Anything while we still have Aaron here? Anything that people wanted to ask?
Thanks for the nice talk, Aaron.
Yeah, thanks for the lots of questions. I think that's very helpful.
Great.
Thanks for the talk.
Thanks.
Okay.
All right. Have a good time.
If not,
thanks
again, Aaron, and thanks everyone for attending. See you guys next week.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, thanks, Aaron.
Yep. Bye, Daniel.
Bye.